You're listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
According to neuroscientist David Eagleman, the conscious mind, the part that you consider you, accounts for a small fraction of the brain's full function. So what's the rest doing? In his latest book, Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain, Mr. Eagleman takes us into the depths of the subconscious to answer some of the deepest mysteries about the human brain. Why is it difficult to keep a secret? What motivates people to care about brands? How much of what we perceive exists outside of us, and how much is a product of our minds? His book is published by Pantheon. I'm very pleased that it brings David Eagleman to our show today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. Great to be here.
Your adventure into how the brain perceives the world around it actually began at the age of 8, didn't it, when you had an accident?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, when I was a kid, I fell off of a house that was under construction, and as I plummeted towards the ground, it seemed to take a very long time. I was thinking about Alice in Wonderland and how this must be what it was like for her to fall down the rabbit hole, and later when I took physics in high school, I calculated and realized it only took 0.8 of a second to get from the roof to the floor. And so I thought that was sort of amazing that our perception of time sometimes doesn't match up with the rest of the world.
I had an experience like that in a car that had slid on some ice, skidded on some ice, and went up in the air and came around. And I thought, gee, this is just like the movies where they suddenly go into slow-mo in scenes like this. But it really was slow-mo, and although all of my life didn't passed before me, time changed.
Exactly. And I think what this illustrates, it's a very good inroad into understanding this issue that our perception of the world is not what we think it is. We have the impression that we open our eyes and voila, there's the world in all its reds and golds and taxicabs and dogs. But in fact, all of this stuff, vision, time, and so on, is a construction of the brain. And as strange as that sounds, it's very easy for us to see that and demonstrate it by looking at nature's experiments with stroke, brain damage, traumatic brain injury, degenerative disorders. What we find is that we are our brains, this 3-pound organ between our ears. When it changes, when its chemical balance changes, when it gets damaged, that can change your capacity for decision making, your ability to see colors, to perceive time, to understand music. Any one of hundreds of bizarre deficits can happen when people get particular kinds of brain damage. And what this teaches us is, my God, we are somehow equivalent to this vast, wet, electrochemical, and essentially utterly alien computational fabric that we find running under the hood.
But we're not like computers in that if a computer has a glitch, the whole thing shuts down. We just adjust and do it a little differently.
That's exactly right. The brain is unlike anything we've ever discovered in the universe. We often reach for computer metaphors just for the speed of language, but the brain is nothing like a computer, right? If you run over half your computer with a truck, it's not going to work. But young brains especially are extremely plastic, which means they can readjust. In children, you can actually remove an entire hemisphere of the brain. This is called a hemispherectomy, and the kid will be just fine. All of the missing functions will rewire up on the available real estate on the other hemisphere.
Because both sides actually take care of almost all of those functions, don't they? Functions kind of stereo-optically, or what word will we use?
Well, I mean, the
in
right
stereo.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, the right and left half of the brain, they're essentially, like duplicates cut out of the same mold. And of course, when there are these surgeries sometimes for epilepsy where the superhighway of fibers that connect the two halves will be cut. And then what's discovered is that patients have essentially two independent brains. And you can do very clever things to feed information to one brain or the other brain, to one side or the other. And they're living independent lives now.
Your mother was a biology teacher. Your father was a psychiatrist who worked with the courts assessing insanity pleas. I could see how you wound up where you are, but did they want you to pursue a career in science?
You know, the way to encourage a child to do anything is to speak favorably in his presence about something, and they never pushed me towards it, but we always had terrific conversations about the brain and biology as well as literature. My parents are both great lovers of literature, and so that's the environment I grew up in.
Although you did come to become the head of a neuroscience department at Baylor rather unconventionally, didn't you? You dropped out of college as a graduate tried your hand at screenwriting, stand-up comedy?
That's right. By the way, I'm not the head of the department at Baylor, but I run a large research laboratory there. I majored in British and American literature as an undergraduate, and after my sophomore year, I left and I moved out to L.A. and I pursued a film career for a little while, and I just felt like college was a little bit. I was busy learning about what other people had done, and I really wanted to get out there and change the world. And you know, I was a dumb 20-year-old. But I was smart enough to know that it would make good sense for me to get out there and try things out in the world. And what happened was, although I was screenwriting and I've always been a real voracious reader of literature, I realized I was also reading books on the brain all the time. That's just what was it's what I was gravitating towards. And at some point I realized that I'd read quite a lot about the brain. And eventually I went back to college, and when I graduated, I called up a graduate school for a PhD in neuroscience, and I said, look, I know I've missed your deadline by 6 months, but I've read all these books. So why don't you ask me what I know, and I'll tell you. And that's how I got into neuroscience graduate school, and I've never looked back. It's been the greatest experience of my life being a neuroscientist.
And we return to that accident that you had as a kid, because that became so important, thinking about things like brain time.
That's right. So a big part of what my laboratory studies is this perception of time. And in the lab, we can very easily demonstrate that we can make you think that something lasted longer or shorter than it actually did. Or we can make you think that something came before something else when it was in fact the other way around. Or that something is flickering at a different rate than it is. And so on. And this allows us to really get under the hood and figure out what are the mechanisms behind this. Because it's not like we're just looking at the world and seeing reality. We are constructing reality.
But you say you had a favorite joke when you were a kid that kind of illustrates this.
Oh, right. Yeah. The joke is that the turtle comes walking into the sheriff's office and he says, "Sheriff, I was just attacked by 3 snails. And the sheriff says, "Well, tell me about it." And he says, "I don't know. It all happened so fast." I loved that because it illustrated to a, 10-year-old kid about temporal relativity.
You met 2 kids who came to an amusement park to get on a zero-gravity ride that had a suspended catch air device. What happened when they got on the ride?
Well, so this is an experiment that I ran where I wanted to know, look, when people think that time actually slows down in a life-threatening situation, can they actually see the world in slow motion like Neo in The Matrix, or is it something else going on? Is it some retrospective illusion having to do with the way memories are laid down? So I took my whole laboratory at one point to the amusement park in Houston called Astroworld, and we went on all the scariest rides, and we brought all our equipment with us and tried to see if we could get this time warping experience. But it turns out none of those rides were scary enough. So I finally had to discover something called SCAD diving, suspended catch air device, where you're dropped from 150 feet in free fall backwards and you're caught in a net below. And it's terrifying because you're falling backwards. You can't see where you're going. You're not attached to anything. And it turns out that is sufficiently scary that people afterwards, when you have them estimate on a stopwatch how long their fall was, there's a duration distortion. They think that it lasted much longer. So what I did with my graduate student, Chess Stetson, is we built a device that we strapped to people's wrist. And this device flashes information at you in such a way that we can measure how fast you're seeing the world. In other words, we can see if you're actually seeing in slow motion. And what we discovered is that people, although they think the event lasted longer, they are not seeing like Neo in The Matrix. It's a retrospective trick of memory. It has to do with the way that memories are laid down during an event such that afterwards you think, my gosh, I noticed this, I noticed that, everything's stuck in there. That must have taken forever. So that gave us an additional step of insight into what's actually happening.
And what does that tell us about the brain?
Well, it tells us time and memory are intertwined irreversibly, and that when we think about these issues, we have to really try to tease these apart and be careful about these things. Essentially, some people have argued that there's actually no such thing as consciousness in the moment. It's all memory. It's your brain saying, okay, what just happened? And you're reconstructing it. And so even consciousness is memory.
My guest is David Eagleman, whose book is called Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain. It is published by Pantheon. You begin your book with a quotation from Blaise Pascal, who noted, now we're talking a 17th century philosopher, man is equally incapable of seeing the nothingness from which he emerges and the infinity in which he is engulfed. And you write that he recognized that we spend our lives on a thin slice between the unimaginably small scales of the atoms that compose us and the infinitely large scales of galaxies. And this is a guy writing this in 1670?
That's right. So Pascal realized we're living on this thin strip. But then what I explore beyond that is that even on our thin strip, we have evolved to deal with certain spatio-temporal scales. The reason we don't get the fabric of reality at the atomic scale or what's happening at cosmic scales is because it's not useful to our cognition from an evolutionary point of view. We are at the scale of rabbits and apples and mates and so on. But what I write about in the book is that we're even much more constrained on this strip than we think. So, for example, electromagnetic radiation is the stuff that visible light is made out of. But it's also the same stuff that radio waves and television signals and X-rays, all of this is electromagnetic radiation. We only see this very thin strip of it, which we call visible light. That's 1/10 billionth of the spectrum. So what this means is that the radio signals from WNYC are passing through our bodies right now, and they're completely invisible to us. Why? Because we don't have the biological receptors to detect those. We do have photoreceptors in the back of our eyes for this particular wavelength, this particular strip of visible light. But most of the signals in the world are completely invisible to us. And if it weren't for centuries of physicists and engineers and so on discovering the stuff and building machines, we would have no reason to imagine it exists. And it turns out that what we take to be reality is completely defined by what our biology is. So if we were a tick, our reality would be defined by warmth and butyric acid. If we were a ghost fish, our reality would be defined by perturbations in an electric field underwater, things like that. And presumably all animals take whatever little bit of the world they're sensing to be reality out there. And it's important for us to start digging down and realizing our limitations.
And along these lines, you quote something from the movie Truman Show. An interviewer asked the producer, "Why do you think Truman has never come close to discovering the true nature of his world?" And the producer replies, "We accept the reality of the world with which we are presented."
That's right. And what we find, even among humans, when you start looking around, you find there are big differences between individuals. One of the things I study in my laboratory is called synesthesia. And this is where people have a blending of the senses. So they might hear music and it causes them to physically see colors, or they hear something and it puts a taste in their mouth physically, or they taste something and it puts a feeling on their fingertips. They're not being artistic or metaphorical. This is an actual cross-signaling in the brain that's happening. And what this indicates is that reality is not one size fits all. Your neighbor might be seeing the world quite differently than you do. One thing we now know is that about 15% of the female population has not just three types of color photoreceptors in their eyes, but they have a fourth type, meaning that they can see colors that you and I can't even imagine. This is part of their reality. It's not part of ours.
So if somebody sees a color, pink, every time the letter A appears, she's actually seeing something that I can't see because I don't have that ability to see that color?
Well, okay, so that is a form of synesthesia. It's actually one of the most popular forms of synesthesia, where things like letters and numbers and weekdays and months will trigger a color experience. So they might look at A on the page and have an experience of pink inside of their heads. Yes, it's because you don't have that same flavor of cross-wiring in your brain, you can look at A all day long and you're never going to have that color experience.
My guest is David Eagleman, who's a neuroscientist at Baylor College of Medicine, where he directs the Laboratory for Perception and Action, as well as the Initiative on Neuroscience and Law. His books on neuroscience include Wednesday is Indigo Blue, Discovering the Brain of Synesthesia, written with Richard Sidowitz, and the forthcoming Live Wired. He's also the author of the international fiction bestseller, Some, 40 Tales from the Afterlives, which inspired YouTube producer Brian Eno to write 12 new pieces of music And he performed them with you at the Sydney Opera House.
Yeah.
The latest book is Back to Real Science. It's called Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain. It is published by Pantheon. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with David Eagleman, whose latest book is Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain. It's published by Pantheon. You've called Chapter 5, The Brain is a Team of Rivals, and you begin with the question, will the true Mel Gibson please stand up? And you talk about Mel Gibson's anti-Semitic rant after he got drunk, but had been drinking with two Jewish guys. I thought that would be the good lead into a joke. Two Jews and Mel Gibson enter a bar.
Right. What happened is, as everyone remembers, he was arrested for drunk driving. He was tested. And he said to the cop, are you a Jew? And it turned out the police officer was Jewish. So Mel Gibson refused to get in the car with him, had to be handcuffed, went on this anti-Semitic rant. Okay, well, what happened after that, after it got leaked on a celebrity website, was he issued a letter of contrition. And he issued a second letter of apology to the Jewish community in particular. And Abraham Foxman, the head of the ADL, accepted the apology eventually and said, you know, he seemed genuinely contrite. So what happened was all the talk shows went nuts about, is Mel Gibson really an anti-Semite or is he not an anti-Semite? Was he really apologetic or not? But it turns out that the brain is not one thing. There's not one you under the surface. People's brains are very complicated because the right way to think about the brains is as a parliament, a team of rivals under the hood there, where you have all these different neural networks that are battling it out to control your behavior.
And we're unaware of most of them?
Unaware of most of this. Exactly right. Although sometimes you can be aware. For example, you know, this is why we can cuss at ourselves and get angry at ourselves and contract with ourselves. If I were to put some rich chocolate cake in front of you, part of you wants to eat that chocolate cake and part of you wants to resist that chocolate cake. And sometimes you can be aware of these battles going on and sometimes you contract with yourself and so on. So when we – and in modern neuroscience now, we can actually use neuroimaging to figure out what these networks are, where they are in the brain, how they're fighting with each other. And the way to think about these is as different political parties in a parliament, just like the Democrats and Republicans and Libertarians and Independents, they all love their country. They just have different ideas about how to go about steering the ship of state. And they battle it out to see who wins.
And you talk about this as dual process.
Well, actually, in the psychology literature, people have used that term dual process. I think there's no reason to imagine it's only limited to two networks. It's actually much richer than that. And as we drill down, we find sort of sub-parties and schisms within parties and so on, just like a parliament. And the key is that there's no head. There's no head that's deciding, okay, this is what we're going to do. It all has to do with how the battles and debates come out. So just to close the circle on the Mel Gibson thing, what this gives us is a much more nuanced view of human nature. There's no reason to imagine that somebody can't have parts of his brain that's racist and other parts that are not racist. Now, this is no way is to defend his despicable behavior, but it is to say –
I've also seen the movie, which would suggest that it's even more complicated than
Well, exactly. So Mel Gibson might not be the perfect example. But the point is that when we try to understand ourselves or other people, it's complicated, right? It's probably a little too simplistic to say that somebody has, well, this is the person's true colors because, in fact, people have different parties that will win in different circumstances.
Well, your father was a consultant on the insanity defense. I'd imagine he would have liked to have been able to invoke this kind of reasoning. But when we go to trial, it's either you're capable or incapable of understanding the result of what you've done.
Well, that's right. I mean, that's in a situation where it's a very damaged sort of parliament. When people plead the insanity defense, that's when they suffer from a deep psychosis where they're completely disconnected from reality. And you know, that's a different sort of thing. That's where the parliament's completely broken. One of the things I really wanted to do in this book is talk about what normal brains are like, brains that aren't suffering from mental illness.
Well, two examples, the cases of Dominique Strauss-Kahn and Casey Anthony, which have obsessed an awful lot of people. Does their contradictory behavior seem like a momentary insanity or dual process, or is it something else?
Well, I mean, these things have to be tried in front of a jury for anybody to make any real statements. I don't know.
From
what
we know
is.
So far.
Well, I mean, look,
is not the first person who has achieved high status in society and who should know better, who's been accused of this sort of thing.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's in some sense, it's a garden variety sort of marital infidelity. And I don't mean to downplay it this way. And if there was any violence or rape involved, that's a different ballgame. But in general, whenever a celebrity is found to have had some sort of infidelity, you know, there's a lot of screaming and yelling and people say they can't believe it. But it's exactly a battle between the short and long-term parts of the brain. These are different political parties. You have parts of your brain that care about instant impulse gratification. They're always in fights with parts of your brain, essentially the frontal lobe, that cares about long-term decision-making. These are always fighting. And when it comes to something like a marriage, people make promises with the long-term parts of their brain, and they mean it. They want to keep that promise. And if they're confronted over and over with the rich chocolate cake in front of them, they have to be a very strong sort of person to not ever have their parliament tip over into that side. Now, again, I'm not defending anybody's marital infidelity, and I certainly don't want to have that in my own marriage. But it is the case that we can look at the neuroscience and understand what's going on. It's not so strange that a celebrity cheats because he's got the chocolate cake in front of him all the time. And at some point in a moment of weakness, he might give in.
Have you done research into lying and also why it's so difficult to keep a secret?
Well, you know, there are several groups that are trying to introduce neuroimaging techniques as a new form of lie detection. And it might end up being slightly better than the polygraph test, which, by the way, is actually pretty good. It comes with the same problems, which is that neither the polygraph test nor the MRI is actually measuring a lie. It's just trying to measure the physiologic response that often accompanies a lie. And it doesn't circumvent the problem that sometimes somebody can be telling the truth, but they're factually incorrect. So there are all sorts of caveats with lie detection. But I was interested when I was putting together this Team of Rivals framework. It struck me at one point the question of what is a secret, because some of my colleagues have found that when people hold secrets, it's really bad for the brain. It increases their stress levels, their number of doctor's visits go up, and so on. And once they've let that secret out, it's quite healthy for them to do so. Their doctor visits go down, and so on. So I started thinking about, well, what is a secret neurobiologically speaking? But I think it's easy to understand with this Team of Rivals, which is that part, you know, some part of your brain wants to tell something. And another part of your brain, maybe the longer-term decision-making parts, don't want the social consequences that will result. And so what you have is this tension, this ongoing battle between parts of your brain, one part which wants to tell and the other is keeping it held in there.
Alberto Moravia wrote a novel once called Woman of Rome, in which a prostitute is told by a client that he killed somebody. And he's doing it to unburden himself. But then she thinks now two of us have the secret. And on top of it all, he now has to worry about her as somebody who knows his secret. So we sometimes we unburden ourselves and then just compound the problem.
Well, that's right. You know what I've noticed is people will often tell very personal things to strangers on airplanes who they know they will never see again, because that's a way to unburden yourself without you know, you're with retaining your anonymity. But I think this is maybe what's behind the confessional in the Catholic Church. It's a way of unburdening yourself. And there are many new things on the net, like postsecret.com and sites like it, where people can go and anonymously unburden themselves of a secret. And if you ever go there, you'll see all sorts of incredibly personal issues.
My guest is David Eagleman, whose latest book is Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain. It's published by Pantheon. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Is it true that people whose names begin with J are more likely to marry other people whose names begin with J?
So a few years ago, some psychologists started looking into this. And what they discovered is when they looked in marriage registries and did the statistics on it, you're more like people who share a first letter of their first name, like Joel and Jenny or Alex and Amy, are more likely to marry each other than would happen by random chance. This is what psychologists call implicit egotism. We like things that sort of remind us of ourselves. And it turns out the same you can find with professions. If your name is Dennis or Denise, you are statistically more likely to become a dentist. If your name is Virginia, you're statistically more likely to move to the state of Virginia and things like that. Now, these are, of course, terrible reasons to choose a life mate or a profession or a place to live. And if you ask people why they did it, it wouldn't be part of their conscious narrative probably. They wouldn't say, well, it was because of this implicit egotism. Nonetheless, there are many unconscious influences on the sorts of decisions that we make.
Including there's a certain predictability. Some people are more likely to do something than the next person. We were talking about cheating before, for example.
Oh, well, that's it turns out that some animal species are monogamous, while most of the rest are not. And so researchers started looking into this and discovered that this has to do with a particular chemical called vasopressin, which seems to be involved in pair bonding and monogamy. So then they got interested in, gosh, does that have anything to do with monogamy in humans? And so it turns out that if you pull the genes for the vasopressin receptor in humans and you look at what's going on, you find that depending on the genes you come to the table with, it seems to correlate with monogamy in humans. So the people who have essentially less binding of vasopressin tend to have more marital problems and more infidelity. Now, I should say genes only give us a predisposition, not a predestination. The way brains come out is a very complicated interaction of genes plus environmental experiences.
Although many years ago, Helen Fisher wrote a book about her theory, which is that divorce rates begin at the point where a child is old enough to walk on his or her own. And so her theory was that we make this kind of contract. This is a genetically, she felt, programmed into us. We make this contract that the male will stay with the female until the child is old enough to walk on its own through the savannah. And then the man will move on. And she saw divorce rates at, I think, 3 or 4 years throughout the world.
Yeah, that's right. Now, okay, so I'd be a little hesitant to go too far with that. I know what we all like, what's appealing somehow, is this idea that, oh, the brain does X, so people are going to behave Y. But in fact, the interesting part about humans is that we're so multi-layered in terms of our cognitive capacities and layering and so on. So what that means is when I'm choosing a mate and when I'm deciding whether to stay married or get divorced, there are many factors involved. There are social factors involved. There are, what will my mother think of this? There are, what are my political aspirations if I'm a politician and how will a divorce affect that? There are, you know, what about my community of friends that I promised at my wedding? I mean, there are a million things that happen with humans. So it is true that there are many influences that we can point at that have evolutionary reasons behind them. But those will probably not provide the complete story when it comes to the complexity of human behavior.
Your book concludes with a chapter, Life After the Monarchy, in which you claim that much of the neuroscience research being conducted has, now should be liberating. Why would it be liberating?
Well, the analogy I draw there is what happened when Galileo finally nailed the proof that we are not at the center of the universe, but instead that Earth's moving around the sun. And what's happened in the intervening 400 years is we've discovered that we're actually not only not at the center, but we're far off on a distant edge of the galaxy. There are more galaxies outside of our own than there are stars within the Milky Way. You know, we're a very small speck. And when Galileo first announced his discovery, it was decried by religious critics as a dethronement of man from his position at the center. Well, Freud suggested that discovering the unconscious, all the stuff that's happening under the hood, would be the next dethronement of man, essentially from the center of ourselves. But what I look at is how terrific the dethronement has been when it comes to the cosmos. Essentially, what we find is that the cosmos is much more magnificent and subtle and wondrous than we ever thought. And when we look to the inner space, that's exactly what we find too.
Are you suggesting that our sense of what's going on in the world is really on the edge of our own brain, our own Milky Way?
It is the case that our conscious mind is living out on a distant edge. hearing just whispers of what's happening in the machinery of the brain.
And what's the rest of the brain doing?
It's doing...
It seems to be fighting against itself.
No, it's... Well, yeah, that's one of its clever techniques, but it's doing everything in your life. Not only things that you can think of like running your heartbeat and your gut and your breathing and all that good stuff, but recognizing a friend's face and how you fall in love. And take, for example, I mean, you're on the radio every day. Words spill out of your mouth faster than you could possibly think of what you're going to say. Your brain's taking care of all of that for you.
You quote a lot of philosophers in this book. Was this kind of thinking the province of philosophers before neuroscientists took it up?
Yeah, you know, and in some sense, we inherit a lot of wonderful things from philosophy, and in another sense, we're sort of taking over that field now, because things that lived once in the realm of speculation, we can actually apply scientific technique to now. You know, of course, we can non-invasively image the human brain while people are doing tasks and making decisions, and this has allowed us to really clean things up a lot and take many hypotheses and weigh in with evidence that rules one out and rules another in.
Pascal, who is obviously a favorite of yours, was also very religious. Do religious experiences come into your neuroscience research? Mysticism, for example, or the fact that some religious people do bad things despite the fact that they have a very strong sense of right and wrong?
Yeah. You know, I mean, there's one sense in which this is outside of my bailiwick. There are people who are studying, some of my colleagues, who are studying religious impulses in the brain. And what you can see is that when people get temporal lobe epilepsy, for example, they become hyper-religious. They hear voices that they attribute to God and so on. What does that mean? Well, you know, who knows exactly? I think a lot of neuroscientists, I mean, we're all tempted to sort of step in and say maybe more than we can about what all of our studies mean for the fundamental fabric of the cosmos. I think truthfully that at this point in history, our science is still very young. And the main thing that we learn in the life of science is the vastness of our ignorance. And we learn some intellectual humility. So I don't know. I'm not a religious person myself, but I don't think we know enough to rule out that there's a lot more interesting things happening in the cosmos, and that, you know, sort of we're nothing but billions of neurons and a mechanical system. We would be able to say that if we had sort of a complete theory of consciousness. Not only do we not, we don't even know what such a theory could possibly look like. We don't know how to take pieces and parts and say, oh, if you put them together in this way and you carry the two and you divide, then now you have the subjective experience of the taste of feta cheese. We don't even know how to approach that problem. So I think we have to remain intellectually humble.
Well, one of the concerns of many religious thinkers has been the whole matter of free will. And you write, the question of free will and why the answer may not matter.
Yeah, it turns out... So people have been debating for millennia now about whether we have free will or we don't. It turns out to be a very difficult one to nail down. There's no killer experiment that shows, oh, yeah, we clearly do or we don't. What I can say with certainty, I believe, is that if free will exists, it's actually something of a bit player in the brain. It only has a limited mobility. And what I mean by that is individual brains are so different because we all come to the table with different genes. We have very different sets of experiences. And as a result, my brain wiring, your brain wiring, someone else's brain wiring are all extremely different. There's essentially as much neural variability as there is with external physical appearances. People are very different on the inside. And what that means is what's important to you and your point of struggle, the battles that you have internally might not be the same as someone else's. So we can't look at a mass murderer and say, well, I wouldn't have used my free will to do that because you've got a different brain than he does. Now, that doesn't forgive him or let him off the hook. We still have to lock him away. But the point is that we can't imagine that free will is the same to all of us because we all have very different brains.
David Eagleman is a neuroscientist at Baylor College of Medicine, where he directs the Laboratory for Perception and Action, as well as the Initiative on Neuroscience and Law. His latest book, Incognito, The Secret Lives of the Brain, is published by Pantheon. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Leonard.